Welcome to the working world. I'm Kara Mendez.
And I'm Jamie Lingham.
Jamie, we spoke with Siobhan Singh, who is a sustainable aviation fuels and green hydrogen subject matter expert. Wow, my brain hurts.
I agree, Kara. And I think that, you know, I mean, this whole, you know, mobility piece and travel and how things have changed from Zoom or something, going back to aviation, travel and shipping. It's just one of the pieces of that whole, you know, sort of global warming and environmental policy conversation. It's just, there was a lot of really good takeouts. It's one of those shows that we do that I sit there and think, far, and I could talk to this guy for days.
I know. We like to keep it short and sharp for our audience. But, yeah, I mean, some of the gems in there, particularly around, he mentioned, you know, the aviation and the shipping sector combined contribute 6% to, you know, the carbon footprint. It's that's some huge numbers, and some of the level of detail that he gave us and the technical terms and reference that he gave throughout this is a good episode for those who are at a mobility level, but those who also like a little bit of geekness around the technology and the science, there's something in here for everybody.
And just to that point, there's going to be in the description, there'll be a paper Siobhan's actually shared with us for those companies who are starting to look at a policy or a way to interact with, you know, reducing emissions through air travel and freight travel. So keep an eye on that one.
Yep, nice takeaway for our viewers as well. Exactly.
Absolutely.
Great. Enjoy, guys. Hi, Siobhan. Welcome to the working world. Nice to see you. How have you been?
I've been very well. Thanks, Karen. Good to see you again, and good to see you, Jamie, as well.
Great to see you as well. Welcome.
Thanks.
Siobhan, we're very honoured to have you on this call and for you to share your thought leadership with us in relation to a greener mobile workforce, particularly in your area of expertise, which is obviously the aviation industry. So I'm going to jump straight into the questions. Look forward to hearing what you've got to share with us. So I guess, you know, we all know that flying around the world has a carbon footprint. Mm-hmm. And I understand, you know, it's a hard to abate sector. So I guess for those in the audience that aren't familiar, what does that mean technically speaking?
Yeah, no, great question. So hard to abate sector means hard to decarbonize. And if I take electric cars as you know, a good comparison, they're, you know, leading the transition out of fossil fuels, and you see a lot of them around. But with aviation and flying, it's actually much harder because essentially you're dealing with mass. You know, there's like four factors, right? A heavy thing that needs to fly. And so whatever technology you choose to decarbonize, it's got to fit in within the mass budgets of the aircraft. And then the other factor is volume. You know, you can't put a huge chunky thing that takes up seat space on an aircraft. So again, you're somewhat limited by what technology goes in because it's a low margin industry and, you know, every paying seat is important. And so a lot of technologies that have come along have looked great, but take up seats, you know, so it is a limiting factor. Two more I thought I'd talk about, you know, is obviously cost. You know, commercial planes cost upwards of $200 million for some of the regional jets. And, you know, these are capital intensive assets that need to be depreciated often over 20 to 30 years. And so that means that there's this really long time period, you know, between which you can't really just swap out an aircraft and replace it with something more fuel efficient quickly. And the last one is safety. You know, you're dealing with, unlike a car, which obviously is safety critical as well, but here you're dealing with an aircraft where any accident has a very high probability of being catastrophic. So any new technology has got to be just tested and tested to stand the test of time and be safe. And unfortunately, fossil fuel right now is that fuel that has a really good reputation from a safety, volume, and energy perspective. That's what makes it hard to abate. Yeah.
Just on that, I think that, you know, if you look at how the car industry is going with technology, I mean, are we going to get an electric plane? Is Elon going to have, you know, this plane charging station? Do we do midair recharging. Yes. I don't know. You know, like I'm just wondering if you're across any of the advancements that they're looking at of how they're going to manage this better.
Yeah, so there are, and you know, this it's more for the smaller aircraft and for flights that are under an hour. So you're looking at carrying current technology, carrying about 5 to 7 people, probably you know, over about a 45-minute flight to an hour if you're lucky. And you have like pure batteries, and then you have
land. Right, yeah, exactly. Sorry, we're sort of out of a battery, maybe.
Yes, that's the battery one. Then you got these fuel cells, right, which actually take hydrogen, but then convert that to electricity. So it's essentially an electrical aircraft. Those can go a little bit further, but yeah, they're still limited to, you know, short hops between cities. And but yes, they are coming. They are being tested right now, and they hold promise for those shorter routes.
I mean, obviously, you raise a very important point around safety and fossil fuels, I guess, being the backbone of maintaining that safety. And safety is obviously foremost when it comes to the aviation industry. Given that and the other challenges you just spoke about in relation to that hard-to-abate piece, how is the aviation sector looking at making planes effectively burn less carbon?
Yeah. So, you know, the biggest lever is the fuel, right? Because the fuel contains carbon, but you can go with low carbon fuels. And what the sector is looking at is what they call drop-in sustainable aviation fuels, or SAFs is the buzzword. Mm-hmm. And you might have seen a lot of headlines around airlines securing access to what the SAF, a sustainable fuel. And it can have up to a 97% reduction in carbon intensity compared to jet fuel. So still contains carbon, but the molecules come from renewable sources like renewable electricity or biogenic crops. And so, you know, it's a lot more friendly, you know, in terms of the environmental footprint. So that's the first lever, low carbon fuels. The other one is operational efficiency. It gets quite interesting. So did you know that you can actually optimize the flight path and optimize the fuel burn at different stages of the flight? So there's a lot of flight navigation innovation going on right now, where they will then essentially optimize the fuel burn of the aircraft over the route. You know, as I mentioned earlier, fuel efficient aircraft is the other lever that the industry is pulling on. So I think COVID and the pandemic really amplified the need for fuel efficient aircraft. So the airlines who can manage that changeover of fleet are going to the newer generation of aircraft. And some of the new engines, there's a Rolls-Royce one that comes to mind, claim to have up to a 25% reduction in fuel efficiency. So you can really get gains by putting in a brand new plane. And then the last one, which I'm quite excited about, is, of course, Airbus. They have these liquid hydrogen-powered aircraft. These are completely new planes that don't burn jet fuel. They burn hydrogen in a liquefied form. It's going to take a bit longer for those to come to market because you have to change the airport that refuels the plane and the plane. But those are coming.
Wow. One thing, early question here that I'm curious about. So I look at it and I think, well, you know, QF18 is going to Sydney regardless, right? Mm-hmm. And it's going to, if I'm on it or not on it, still up in the air.
Yeah.
So, and I know this is probably going to sound like a silly question to you, but I'm genuinely curious. So exactly how much difference does it make if me at 80 plus kilos is on that flight or not on that flight? What does that do to the carbon emissions? Is it a big percentage, or is it just such a minuscule percentage it doesn't really matter?
Yeah, it is. It is a fractional percentage, I think, of whether you're there or not. But it plays back probably to the economics of flying, right? Because if the seat's empty, then it starts costing the airline and actually making it more difficult for them to invest in the more expensive low-carbon fuels. So that's probably the factor. And you'd notice sometimes flights are canceled. That's an extreme case. It happens a lot in the US, extreme case where there's just too many empty seats for the flight to be economical. And they just then bump everyone onto the next slot, and you've just got to wait.
Yeah.
Now I know why all these flights I keep getting.
Yeah, same. I've got a couple of them to say. Yeah.
Yep.
And look, to be honest, from a global mobility industry perspective, we're seeing similar, I guess, behaviours in different other sectors as well. So the shipping industry, for example, has also shifted some of their approaches, optimised their lanes, not reintroduced post-pandemic some lane shipping routes that they used to. And so all of this is probably demystifying for me, particularly into reasons why that is. So just on that point in relation to the shipping industry, I mean, there's obviously lots of parallels between, program or service delivery in relation to aviation and shipping industry and how that intersects with, I guess, what you're referring to as green fuels. I wondered whether you're able to share with us the carbon impacts for our mobility watchers out there, the carbon impacts of the moving someone and their personal goods to work in another country, and I guess some of the considerations that mobility professionals can start thinking about to address this within their mobility programs.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can even comment from a personal perspective, right? Having moved countries several times together with furniture and everything and watching, you know, from the house, the truck taking this big container then to a ship, you know, and then putting the family in the plane. So that whole, you know, carbon impact off that. And, you know, some interesting stats on shipping, Karen, which you mentioned about shipping lanes. You know, overall, the shipping industry actually has a similar carbon impact that aviation has. So both of them contribute about 3% of all anthropogenic carbon emissions, so all human emissions. So together, shipping and aviation are responsible for 6% of all anthropogenic, you know, emissions. Ships do emit less CO2 per ton than planes, but they use the lowest grade of fuel possible. It's called bunker fuel. And it is like a thick sludge. It actually needs to be heated to be pumped. But it's cheap, but unfortunately dirty. So it has a very high particulate content. So even though it's less fuel burn than in a plane per kilometer or per ton, it's a lot dirtier. And, you know, shipping emissions, you know, because of the increase in home deliveries and increase of people mobility, really, they're set to increase by 130% from 2008 levels if they go unchecked. Fortunately, the shipping industry is also, you know, looking at decarbonizing, but it's a bit harder. And you know, obviously there are considerations that the industry can take, you know, in whether to move someone, and I think it gets into an interesting space, right? To reflect, do you actually need all your furniture to be moved? And, you know, if it's a temporary assignment, could you actually store your furniture in your home country rather than buy it on the other side? Could you rent furniture? But even the shipping company and choosing a shipping company, some of them ship containers full on the one trip, but actually ship them back empty. And so it's about leaning towards shipping companies that lease containers in both directions. And then the newer shipping companies are actually starting to buy low carbon ships that run on methanol and ammonia. And it's about finding out which companies are doing that and trying to choose them as service providers.
I think to that good point about saying, you know, do you really need the furniture? I'm just curious in your own, you know, you said you've moved around a fair bit. I suppose the company, what do they say? Here you go, here's a 20-foot container. You go, okay, I'm going to fill it. I've got this old couch that I've, you know, dragged from Australia to Canada to the US back to, you know what I mean? Like, do you think that there's a lot of people who are just dragging stuff because they have the space?
Yes, true. There's, you know, that, I mean, some of it is just not being aware, right, that there are a few ways to pack a container that might be more efficient. And I think that principle of reuse, you know, of taking that move maybe as an opportunity to kind of clean out, get rid of old stuff, you know, and then, you know, even buy things that might be slightly used, not so much about cost. Yes, there's cost advantages, but it's about the carbon life cycle of an item of furniture getting used again, where you really are benefiting the environment by buying some used stuff when you move as well.
Karen, I wonder if that could be a good little mobility policy where you might say to someone, okay, I'll, you know, you can get up to a 20-foot container, but if you only use a 10-foot container, I'll give you X, you know, financial incentive or a credit for, you know, a furniture store in your destination country. I don't know. I think there's got to be some ways because, as Siobhan said, if there's, you know, 120%, 130% increase in movement of these types of things, there has to be, I mean, the industry really has to be working towards that, right?
Yeah. Look, there, Jamie, there are organisations that are already looking at that, and I think what you're really getting at is around kind of incentivising the mobile workforce to make the greener choice. Yes, and a lot of mobility programs are starting to think about that. Yeah. This podcast is obviously designed to get those people thinking as well, mm-hmm. and to encourage that conversation along to the next stage, which is putting it into policy, partnering with greener partners to make those choices and being aware of what your partners are actually doing themselves.
Yeah, like that, the one with the containers going back and forth. I mean, I had no idea that, you know, and it just seems that there's one shipping company that takes full containers across and doesn't try and take anything back.
Where there are organisations too that take those empty spaces and sell that almost kind of like, a, I guess, an Uber, and they backfill it to make sure that that's optimally packed and that shipping lane is then used in an optimal fashion. So,
fantastic.
Yeah, it's happening, Jamie.
That's a really good idea. Love it.
And it's a fantastic segue to my next question, which is, I guess, Siobhan, you know, we spoke about aviation, spoke about shipping, but I guess, you know, bundling all that up together for organisations who operate at global scale and in respects to, I guess, not just their mobility programs but their business travel programs as well, how can they look to reduce their carbon footprint for their mobile staff, in your view?
You know, the challenge with low carbon fuels right now is actually the price. So they haven't achieved the scale needed. And the industry, you know, is both the airline and shipping industry are looking at a user pays model. But, you know, your average kind of mom and pop travelers don't necessarily manage to bridge that price premium. And so for corporates, that's where there is an opportunity. It's more probably initially more tractable for corporates to absorb the cost up front. And I think, you know, consider joining a corporate green fuels program. There's a lot of them starting up. Qantas, for example, has what's called a SAF coalition, Sustainable Aviation Fuel Coalition, where you can actually buy into parcels of sustainable fuel that are then used for your corporate flights, you know. And, you know, the same would apply to shipping. Organizations like DHL are leading the way. You know, in March of this year, I was quite impressed to see DHL Express, you know, sign up to purchase 800 million liters of sustainable aviation fuel until 2026. That's the largest corporate purchase of fuel, you know, for essentially cargo travel. And, you know, that purchase gave CO2 savings or resulted in CO2 savings about 400,000 passenger cars taken off the road. So these can be significant, but they do require some intervention from corporates to both reduce their scope 3 or scope 2 emissions, as the industry calls it, or, you know, with your consulting companies that have very high travel, it would be considered scope 1, which is quite important in terms of the social license to operate for those corporates.
So it interests me about the initiatives that airlines are taking, because it feels a little bit counterintuitive that they'd be trying to encourage people not to travel. Or I don't know if they're actually saying don't travel, or are they just saying travel greener, you know what I mean? So it feels like a bit of an interesting thing to say, okay, we recognise that we're part of the problem. How do we still maintain a business, maintain profitability, and do our core function, which is moving people around the world? What sort of programs are you seeing these, you know, the airlines come out with? I suppose I'm just going to stick with the airlines because it seems to be, you know, the obvious one for me.
Yeah. You know, Europe is taking an interesting view, right? So there are, especially in France, for example, some of the airlines have shares in train companies. So there, the rail is an option, right? So mode switching, so to speak, which is where you'd use a different mode of transport. I think they've been experimenting with having a policy that any travel less than 2.5 hours in duration must be by rail. You know, it can't be by plane. Obviously, here in Australia, New Zealand, and, you know, countries like the US that have very large separation between cities, it's not necessarily viable to do that, to mode switch. But you do have either, you know, as you say, travel less or travel greener, these two options being available, or like what we're doing right now, right, which is to use, you know, tools available to remote into meetings and events and then minimize the carbon impact of traveling.
Yeah, that mode switching, whilst I haven't heard that term before, I've seen large consulting organizations starting to implement that as part of their mobility policy, particularly in the EMEA region. But yeah, not so much.
Yeah,
a little bit more challenging with our geographical location.
Yes.
I guess, you know, again, as Jamie said, probably sticking with the aviation industry because it's probably the most well-worn path for our viewers. What timelines has that sector put in place around decarbonization?
So in 2021, IATA, which is the International Air Traffic Aviation Authority, they're like the overarching body that regulates aviation, and airlines, you know, subscribe to what they dictate. They committed to airlines achieving net zero emissions by 2050. And then off the back of that, you know, airlines have, most of them have gone with a target of about 10% sustainable fuel by 2030, and then having some other kind of ramping up of using sustainable fuel from 2030 onwards. Sustainable fuels, you know, are used typically at 10%, but can be blended up to 50%. And so there are some airlines that are a little bit more ambitious and are able to go with, you know, an even higher carbon reduction. I think from now till about 2035, you're going to see fuel electric planes starting on, and as I mentioned earlier, the shorter routes for your short hops, those liquid hydrogen planes on shorter routes. But the liquid hydrogen ones, unfortunately, will only come from about 2040 because you really have to start actually changing the airport terminals to service those planes. So there'll be different technologies getting phased in, but essentially at those checkpoints of 2030, you know, 2035, 2040, going up to 2070.
So are we then likely as consumers to see price increases across, you know, the next couple of decades?
Very likely, yes.
Because it's going to be funded somehow, right?
That's right, yeah.
So just to that point, I think that obviously with things like rising petrol costs or oil costs, how is these other fuels that we're using, the SAFs, how are they produced? Like what sort of fuels are they? I've got no idea what, you know, where do you get them from?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's such an interesting question, right? And this is where I'd be tempted to go in a very long lecture, but I'll give you the simplified version.
you can simplify to mid zone if you like. I'm quite interested. Yeah.
So drop-in, there's two buckets, right? There's drop-in fuels that must work on existing aircraft because you want to have a fuel that can be blended in and mixed in and actually just works from the word go without needing to change that very expensive plane. And those drop-in fuels, to make them work on existing aircraft, they have to be chemically equivalent to jet fuel. It's got to burn in exactly the same way as jet fuel. And so the advantage is it means it uses existing pipelines to the airport and existing manufacturing processes mostly. It is the front end of those manufacturing processes that gets complex and is quite capital intensive because you have to get those molecules from renewable sources. So you can look at things like municipal waste, where they essentially get the hydrogen and carbon out and use that to assemble the molecules for jet fuel that are within the jet fuel range, as they call it. You get used cooking oil, even tallow. These are all feedstocks that go in. And then power to liquids, which is where you actually just take renewable power, push it through water. I'm oversimplifying, but lots of power through lots of water.
This sounds easy. Yeah,
is that amazing?
And then from that, you get the hydrogen out, and then you get the carbon. One of the technologies is direct air capture. We're getting carbon out of the air. It's still got a long way to go. And then direct ocean capture, where you capture carbon from the oceans. And both of them are, you know, essentially getting reusing carbon. And you assemble the hydrogen and carbon in a way that looks chemically the same as jet fuel and burns like jet fuel. So that's a little bit of insight into that world. But it gets very interesting, and every scientist and engineer like me starts rubbing their hands together.
Yeah, it sounds fascinating.
Question like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Siobhan, I don't know if you've seen it in the media, but there has recently been an initiative released by the Japan Airlines where they're offering a service for travellers where they have the option to rent their wardrobe at destination locations. Now, obviously, this is in an effort to reduce luggage weights and, you know, as you've described, then translates to using less fuel across their fleet. I guess my question for you is, what impact does this initiative have in practice? And more importantly, would you personally use this service?
Yeah. So your short answer is yes, absolutely. Would use a service like that. Because if you think about it, if you have a luggage allowance of, say, 60 kilograms, 60 to 80, right? Because two bags per flight, or if it's a relocation, it's probably more. Multiply that by 200 to 300 passengers. It's a lot of mass that is going into moving that clothing around. So I think the principle of renting clothing for a, you know, what would be a temporary overseas trip is sound, because it means that the pilot can choose a lower fuel load, because there are guidelines for fuel use, but at the start of every flight, the pilot actually makes a judgment call on how much fuel to take. And that's based on what the load is for that flight. And it's a parallel, Karen, to renting furniture, you know, for a corporate move where you're renting clothes for your short hops. And, you know, again, the interesting thing is not only are you saving mass, but those clothes are getting reused as well, or the furniture is getting reused if you're renting furniture, and which means you need to theoretically make less of them, which has another environmental benefit.
Good point.
It's another good, you know, sort of side revenue stream for Japan Airlines as well, though, isn't it? They want to say, okay, well, let's get into the furniture business or the clothes business.
True. Didn't even think of that.
It's a diverse source. I was thinking of something else while you were talking. I mean, it's just so I was going to say that, you know, I'm the sort of person that I know that my car can go 20 kilometres when it's actually on zero petrol, so I'd probably not the guy that you'd want to have on the fuel loads. But back to something you said earlier about, you know, there being better ways and better routes that planes can go and at a better speeds and at better heights. So the immediate question in my mind is, why wouldn't we be doing that all the time now?
Yeah. It comes to the, call it the granularity of GPS technology and how accurately you can track where the plane is. And then, you know, also the efficiency with which your air traffic control tower software is tracking where all the planes are. And again, it's a detail resolution challenge, you know, where, you know, they're tracking, you know, hundreds of planes. And the current technology only allows for, you know, it has some limitations on what those planes can do. So they, at the moment, would just be kind of going, you know, the simplest parts, whereas the new technology would have much faster computers, much better GPS to know exactly where the planes are and then be able to manage that air traffic so that, you know, things are flying safely at a safe distance, but being a bit more creative about what heights they are at and how much fuel they're burning at different stages of the flight.
So obviously different height means different level of fuel that they're burning at the time. Would that be correct?
Because the and getting a bit technical there, you know, it's the change in air density. So you notice when a plane is starting to land, it appears to go a lot more slowly. And it is because at a lower altitude, you've got, you know, essentially a higher air density. And so that plane needs less speed to stay within its flight envelope. Whereas, you know, conversely, when you're higher up, you need more speed to achieve flight.
My favorite definition, that was the atmospheric ocean. You know, it's like you're going through the ocean, and as you go up, obviously, you get, and that's how I explain my turbulence to my kids. I'm like, you know, it's like just like we're in the ocean, it's fine. You hit a few bumps. And I remember always saying to my kids, particularly when they're younger, every time we'd hit turbulence, they go, oh, that tricky pilot, he's just giving us a bit of a shake to make sure we're all awake. My kids would love it. So,
yeah, yeah, it is a really, really good way to describe it, you know, that atmospheric density and how it varies and then how it affects the burn of fuel and other things like contrails, which is, you know, the emissions, the other emissions apart from CO2, which planes make as well.
Can you just explain that a bit more? Sorry, Karen. I'm just curious on those contrails as well.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, in addition to CO2, there's also sulfur dioxide and, or they call it SOx and NOx, and the nitrogen compounds that come out of fuel. Those are like particulates, call it soot, if you will. And those, you know, some of them crystallize in the atmosphere as well. And so have other effects then on other harmful effects in the environment. There's a lot less of those emissions that occur, but they do carry their own carbon intensity. And so the industry is tracking both the carbon intensity of carbon and then the, call it the detrimental effects of those other gases that I emitted, and trying to, you know, really take the whole package and reduce the impact of all of them.
Yeah. Yeah,
Jamie mentioned the pilots as kind of part of this whole solution, right? I imagine that pilots would, and airlines are already engaging their pilots to do training around those kind of more optimal flight paths, use of fuel. Is that something that's starting to increase in their training and what we're focusing on?
There are, yeah, pilot training, operator training, and then, you know, getting a balance between the margin of safety of fuel that you need in reserve. Mm-hmm. So coming, you know, not having a Jamie situation of only 20 kilometers to go.
I know it so well.
Mm. Yeah. So, you know, having that balance where, and there, you know, FAA does dictate, you know, limits, minimum fuel load that you have to have. Sure. But then on the upper end, also ensuring that the mass of the overall fuel can be managed so that you can, then optimize how much fuel you put in total. So yeah, pilot training is a big factor so they can make more informed decisions. They do have to stick to flight paths that the airport, you know, compels them to as far as possible. They actually have to have a good explanation if they deviate from those. So it does then come back to that whole ecosystem of how the flight management software and the navigation software works and whether it allows the plane to safely be a bit more creative about what it does, you know, to optimize the fuel. But at the end of the day, it saves costs and the airlines, you know, want that to happen. So it's all moving in the right direction.
I mean, if you could take away sitting in a holding pattern for an hour over a city, that would be pretty amazing, because I think that, you know, the amount of times that you get that, you know, that for some reason the runway is not ready, which I don't understand, because they sort of knew you were coming the whole time. It's not like you just sort of dropped in. just one more thing. You know, there's so many, I mean, this has been such a fascinating conversation. And there's so many stakeholders involved, you know, like obviously there's the airlines and you know, different government bodies and governing bodies, the AI. ARTR, whatever the group was called. And I also noticed there's another initiative that's being put out there. I think it's the C40 cities, which a lot of the global mayors have put on there. And I read their environmental policy, and it really talks about, you know, flights, air travel, and is it necessity in getting sign-off. What trends are you seeing through the mobility industry to this level? And I suppose the question is, are these other stakeholders starting to interact more with companies and saying, okay, well, we've got these organisations and we've got these targets, net zero by 2050, 10% sustainable. So how much does industry, these aviation industry and government, how much do they liaise with actual, you know, companies who practice a lot of global mobility?
Yeah, it's... You know, there's a lot of activity going on right now. So with IATA, for example, you know, the airlines, you know, all subscribe to them and they all get together for annual conferences. The likes of Boeing and Airbus as well also get the airlines together, you know, get the whole community together. And, you know, they all are working together. There's an organization called the First Mover Coalition, which is part of the World Economic Forum. And that is a group of corporates, you know, has some similarities to the C40 initiative, but this is where corporates have intentionally signed up to purchase higher cost fuel, low carbon fuel at a higher cost. And they've all signed up to a certain percentage. So you have some airlines and corporates, you know, signing up to that. And then, as I mentioned earlier, you have coalitions like the Sustainable Aviation Fuel Coalition, which Qantas is doing, and United Airlines and others, Lufthansa, for instance, all have similar initiatives, corporate programs, where you're going in, you know, and buying fuel. Companies like, especially in the West Coast of the U.S., the major ones like Microsoft, for example, also intentionally buy sustainable fuel for their flights for certain routes. So you have what's called green routes also, which is another lever to pull where you can put sustainable fuel onto a route and you know that that route is going to have the low carbon fuel. And that's becoming popular as well. But yes, Jamie, lots of urgency in the industry right now, and they're either being mandated to change, which is the case in Europe, or they're being incentivized, you know, to change, which is the case in the US. And I think Australia and New Zealand are somewhere in between, where we're doing a lot of lobbying with governments to try to come up with functional policy, which will either compel or incentivize the industry to comply with the minimum targets as well. Because at the moment, it's self-regulating in this region until the law comes into effect.
So for the audience, if I was a mobility practitioner watching this and I wanted to get some information, or, you know, if this is new to me, how do I start is there a certain place, I mean, would you go for the First Mover Coalition or are there somewhere else you'd go to try and start to get a bit of a policy or guidelines or just a bit of an understanding? Because I'm sure that there's people in different stages, you know, with their policies. And as I said, if there's someone out there who would say, like, hey, I'm just at the start, where would you suggest that they go?
There's some wonderful, guides for, you know, new users to the market. So one of them, which is a bit of a longer document, it's called the Waypoint or Waytag 2050 report. That is by the World Economic Forum. And then there's another kind of short and sharp 10-page guide by IATA, which I'm happy to share in your show notes as well, which people can download. A good starting place to just give you an overview of what the levers are to decarbonize and what you can do as well from your perspective.
I think that'd be really useful if we get the IATA document. I think that'd be, as I said, I'm sure that, you know, like there's so much in this. We've sort of, I feel like we've just, you know, had a quick look in this, a quick look inside, and there's so much going on. It's like complex machinery, you know, it's really, there's so much. I mean, your head must be full of this stuff all the time.
It is, yes. And I find lots of fun as well. It's one of those big waves, big challenges that needs to be solved for humanity. And so, pretty important to get into the detail of what's available in terms of technology and what we can do.
Absolutely.
Amazing, Siobhan. Thank you so much for sharing a small snippet, to Jamie's point, into this topic. But hopefully there's been some really good takeaways in there for our audience, particularly, sharing that link to that document would be very much appreciated for our audience. And thank you so much for your time and your thought leadership. And wow, that's all I've got to say.
Thank you.
It's been really insightful. I'm sure we'd still be on your question talking about the alternative fuels and how they fit into, the existing framework of engines and things like that. It's been enlightening. It's been great. It is obviously such an important issue. And I think, hopefully air travel will still remain down the track. I think that it feels like it's increased a lot as far as, personal travel and stuff goes. There's a few places I certainly want to take my kids and go to travel. So, but it's, it's been fantastic.
Thank you. And thanks for creating the forum to speak about this. Appreciate it.
No worries. Thanks, Siobhan. All right. Thanks,
Siobhan. Okay. Have a great day. Take care. See you all.
Bye.
Bye-bye.